your inheritance. His coy response frustrates me. I pick up the lock and try to force it open, as I've always tried doing. Of course, it doesn't budge.
You can't open it without me, and I can't open it without you, Henri says.
Well, how do we open it? There isn't a keyhole.
By will.
Oh, come on, Henri, quit being secretive. He takes the lock from me.
The lock only opens when we're together, and only after your first legacy appears.
He walks to the front door and sticks his head out. Then he closes and locks it. He walks back.
Press your palm against the side of the lock, he says, and I do.
It's warm, I say.
Good. That means you're ready.
Now what? He presses his palm against the other side of the lock and interlocks his fingers with mine. A second passes. The lock snaps open. Amazing, I say.
It's protected by a Loric charm, just like you are. It can't be broken. You could run over it with a steamroller, and it wouldn't even be dented. Only the two of us can open it together. Unless I die, then you can open it yourself.
Well, I say, I hope that doesn't happen. I try to lift the top of the box, but Henri reaches over and stops me.
Not yet, he says. There are things in here you aren't ready to see. Go, sit on the couch.
Henri, come on!
Just trust me, he says.
I shake my head and sit down. He opens the box and removes a rock that is probably 6 inches long, 2 inches thick. He relocks the box, then brings the rock over to me. It is perfectly smooth and oblong, clear on the outside but cloudy in the center. What is it? I ask.
A Loric crystal.
What's it for?
Hold it, he says,
handing it to me. The second my hands come into contact with it, both lights snap on in my palms. They are even brighter than the day before. The rock begins to warm. I hold it up to look more closely at it. The cloudy mass in the center is swirling, turning in on itself like a wave. I can also feel the pendant around my neck heating up. I'm thrilled by all this new development. My whole life has been spent impatiently waiting for my powers to arrive. Sure, there were times when I hoped they never would, mainly so we could finally settle somewhere and live a normal life. But for now, holding a crystal that contains what looks like a ball of smoke in its center, and knowing my hands are resistant to heat and fire, and that more legacies are on their way that will then be followed by my major power, the power that will allow me to fight. Well, it's all pretty cool and exciting. I can't wipe the smile from my face. What is happening to it?
It's tied to your legacy. Your touch activates it. If you weren't developing Lumen, then the crystal itself would light up the way your hands are. Instead, it's the other way around.
I stare at the crystal, watching the smoke circle and glow.
Shall we start?
Henri asks. I nod my head rapidly. Hell yes! The day has turned cold. The house is silent, aside from the occasional gust of wind rattling the windows. I lie on my back on top of the wooden coffee table. My hands dangle over the sides. At some point, Henri will build a fire beneath them both. My breathing is slow and steady, as Henri has instructed.
You have to keep your eyes closed, he says. Just listen to the wind. There might be a slight burning in your arms when I drag the crystal up them. Ignore it as best as you can.
I listen to the wind blow through the trees outside. I can somehow feel them sway and bend. Henri begins with my right hand. He presses the crystal against the back of it, then pushes it up my wrist and onto my forearm. There is a burn as he has predicted, but not enough of one to make me pull my arm free.
Let your mind drift, John. Go where you need to go.
I don't know what he's talking about, but I try to clear my mind and breathe slowly. All at once, I feel myself drift away. From somewhere, I can feel the sun's warmth upon my face, and a wind far warmer than what is blowing beyond our walls. When I open my eyes, I'm no longer in Ohio. I'm above a vast expanse of treetops. Nothing but jungle as far as I can see. Blue sky. The sun beating down. A sun almost double the size of Earth's. A warm, soft wind blows through my hair. Down below, rivers forge deep ravines that cut through the greenery. I am floating above one of them. Animals of all shapes and sizes, some long and slender, some with short arms and stout bodies, some with hair, and some with dark-colored skin that looks rough to the touch, are drinking from the cool waters at the river's bank. There is a bend in the horizon line far off in the distance, and I know that I am on Lorien. It's a planet 10 times smaller than Earth, and it's possible to see the curve of its surface when looking from far enough away. Somehow, I'm able to fly. I rush up and twist in the air, then torpedo down and speed along the river's surface. The animals lift their heads and watch with curiosity, but not with fear. Lorien, in its prime, covered with growth inhabited by animals, in a way, it looks like what I imagine Earth looked like millions of years ago, when the land ruled the lives of its creatures before humans arrived and started ruling the land. Lorien in its prime. I know that it no longer looks like this today. I must be living a memory. Surely it isn't my own. And then the day skips ahead to darkness. Off in the distance, a great display of fireworks begins, rising high in the sky and exploding into shapes of animals and trees, with the dark sky and the moons and a million stars serving as a brilliant backdrop.
I can feel their desperation,
I hear from somewhere. I turn and look around me. There is nobody there.
They know where one of the others is, but the charm still holds. They can't touch her until they've killed you first, but they continue to track her.
I fly up high, then dip low, seeking the source of the voice. Where is it coming from?
Now is when we have to be most cautious. Now is when we have to stay ahead of them.
I push forward towards the fireworks. The voice unnerves me. Perhaps the loud booms will drown it out.
They had hoped to kill us all well before your legacies developed, but we've kept hidden. We have to stay calm. The first three panicked. The first three are dead. We have to stay smart and cautious. When we panic is when mistakes are made. They know it will only get harder for them the more developed the rest of you are. And when you are all fully developed, the war will be waged. We will hit back and seek our revenge, and they know it.
I see the bombs fall from miles above Lorien's surface. Explosions shake the ground and the air. Screams carry on the wind. Bursts of fire sweep across the land and the trees. The forest burns. There must be 1,000 different aircraft, all dropping from high in the sky to land on Lorien. Mogadorian soldiers pour out, carrying guns and grenades that hold powers far greater than what is used in warfare here. They are taller than we are, and still look similar except in the face. They have no pupils, and their irises are a deep magenta color, some of them black. Dark, heavy circles rim their eyes, and there's a pallor to their skin. An almost discolored, bruised quality to it. Their teeth glint between lips that never seem to close, teeth that look filed, coming to an unnatural point. The beasts of Mogador come off the plains close behind, the same cold look in their eyes. Some of them are as big as houses, razor teeth showing, roaring so loud that it hurts my ears.
We got careless, John. That is how we were defeated so easily, he says.
I know now that the voice I'm hearing is Henri's, but he is nowhere to be seen, and I can't take my eyes off the killing and the destruction below me to look for him. People are running everywhere, fighting back. As many Mogadorians as Lorik are being killed, but the Lorik are losing the battle against the beasts, which are killing our people by the dozens, breathing fire, gnashing teeth, viciously swinging arms and tails. Time is speeding along, going much faster than normal. How much has passed? An hour? Two? The guard lead the fight, their legacies on full display. Some are flying, some able to run so fast that they become a blur, and some disappear entirely. Lasers shoot from hands. Bodies become engulfed in flames. Storm clouds are brewed, coupled with harsh winds above those able to control the weather. But they are still losing. They are outnumbered 500-1. Their powers are not enough.
Our guard had dropped. The Mogadorians had planned well, picking that exact moment when they knew we were at our most vulnerable, when the planet's elders were gone. Pittacus Lor, the greatest of them, their leader, had assembled them before the attack. Nobody knows what happened to them, or where they went, or if they are even still alive. Perhaps the Mogadorians took them out first, and once the elders were out of the way, that is when they attacked. All we really know is that there was a column of shimmering white light that shot into the sky, as far as anyone could see on the day the elders assembled. It lasted the entire day, then vanished. We, as a people, should have recognized it as a sign that something was amiss, but we didn't. We have no one to blame but ourselves for what happened. We were lucky to get anyone off the planet, much less 9 young guard who might someday continue the fight and keep our race alive.
Off in the distance, a ship shoots high and fast into the air, a blue stream following behind it. I watch it from my vantage point in the sky until it disappears. There is something familiar about it. And then it dawns on me. I am in that ship, and Henri is too. It's the ship carrying us to Earth. The Lorik must have known they were beaten. Why else would they send us away? Useless slaughter. That is how it all looks to me. I land on the ground and walk through a ball of fire. Rage sweeps through me. Men and women are dying. Guard and Sepan, along with defenseless children. How can this be tolerated? How can the hearts of the Mogadorians be so hardened as to do all this? And why was I spared? I lunge at a nearby soldier, but go straight through him and fall down. Everything I am witnessing has already happened. I am a spectator of our own demise, and there's nothing I can do. I turn around and face a beast that must be 40 feet tall, broad-shouldered, with red eyes and horns 20 feet in length. Drool falls from its long, sharp teeth. It lets out a roar, and then lunges. It passes through me, but takes out dozens of Lorik around me. Just like that, every one of them gone. And the beast keeps going, taking out more Lorik. Through the scene of destruction, I hear a scratching noise, something separate from the carnage on Lorien. I am drifting away, or drifting back. 2 hands press down upon my shoulders. My eyes snap open, and I'm back in our home in Ohio. My arms are dangling over the coffee table. Inches below them are two cauldrons of fire, and both of my hands and wrists are completely submerged in the flames. I don't feel the effects at all. Henri stands over me. The scratching I heard a minute ago is coming from the front porch.
What is that?
I whisper, sitting up.
I don't know, he says.
We are both silent, straining to listen. Three more scratches at the door. Henri looks down at me.
There's somebody out there,
he says. I look at the clock on the wall. Nearly an hour has passed. I'm sweating, out of breath, unsettled by the scenes of slaughter I just witnessed. For the first time in my life, I truly understand what happened on Lorien. Before tonight, the events were just part of another story, not all that different from the many I have read in books. But now, I have seen the blood, the tears, the dead. I have seen the destruction. It's a part of who I am. Outside, darkness has set in. Three more scratches at the door, a low groan. We both jump. I immediately think of the low groans I heard coming from the beasts. Henri rushes into the kitchen and grabs a knife from the drawer beside the sink.
Get behind the couch.
What? Why?
Because I said so.
You think that little knife is going to take down a Mogadorian?
If I hit them straight in the heart, it will. Now get down.
I scramble off the coffee table and crouch behind the sofa. The two cauldrons of fire are still going, faint visions of Lorien still moving through my mind. An impatient growl comes from the other side of the front door. There is no mistaking that somebody, or something, is out there. My heart races.
Keep down,
Henri says. I lift my head so that I can peer over the back of the couch. All that blood, I think. Surely, they knew they were outmatched. But they fought to the end anyway, dying to save each other, dying to save Lorien. Henri grips the knife tightly. He slowly reaches for the brass knob. Anger sweeps through me. I hope it is one of them. Let a Mogadorian come through that door, he'll meet his match. There's no way I'm staying behind this couch. I reach over and grab one of the cauldrons, thrust my hand into it, and pull out a burning piece of wood with a pointed end. It's cool to the touch, but the fire burns on, sweeping over and around my hand. I hold the piece of wood like a dagger. Let them come, I think. There will be no more running. Henri looks over at me, takes a deep breath, and rips the front door open. Chapter 9. Every muscle in my body is flexed, everything tense. Henri jumps through the doorway, and I am ready to follow. I can feel the thud, thud, thud in my chest. My fingers are white-knuckled around the piece of wood still burning. A gust of wind bursts through the door, and the fire dances in my hand and crawls up my wrist. No one is there. All at once, Henri's body relaxes, and he chuckles, looking down at his feet. There, looking up at Henri through the tops of his eyes, is the same beagle I saw yesterday at school. The dog wags his tail and paws at the ground. Henri reaches down and pets him. Then the dog pushes past and trots into the house with his tongue dangling. What's he doing here? I ask.
You know this dog?
I saw him at school. He was following me around yesterday after you dropped me off. I put the piece of wood back and wipe my hands on my jeans, leaving a trail of black ash down the front. The dog sits at my feet and looks up expectantly, his tail thumping against the hardwood floor. I sit on the couch and watch both fires burn. Now that the excitement of the situation is over, my mind goes back to what I just saw in my vision. I can still hear the screams in my ears, still see the way the blood shimmered in the grass in the moonlight, still see the bodies in fallen trees, the red glow in the eyes of the beasts of Mogador, and the terror in the eyes of the Lorik. I look at Henri. I saw what happened, at least the beginning of it. He nods.
I thought you might.
I could hear your voice. Were you talking to me?
Yes.
I don't understand, I say. It was a massacre. There was too much hatred for them to only be interested in our resources. There was more to it than that. Henri sighs and sits on the coffee table across from me. The dog jumps into my lap. I pet him. He's filthy, his coat stiff and oily under my hand. There is a tag in the shape of a football attached to the front of his collar. It's an old tag, most of the brown paint worn away. I take it in my hand, the number 19 on one side, the name Bernie Kosar on the other. Bernie Kosar? I say. The dog wags his tail. I guess that's his name. Same as that dude in the poster on my wall. Popular guy around here, I guess. I run my hand down his back. He doesn't seem like he has a home, I say. And he's hungry. Somehow, I can tell. Henri nods. He looks down at Bernie Kosar. The dog stretches out, rests his chin on his paws, and closes his eyes. I flip open the lighter and hold the flame over my fingers, then my palm, then run it up the underside of my arm. Only when the flame is an inch or two away from my elbow do I feel the burn. Whatever Henri has done has worked, and my resistance has spread. I wonder how long it will take until all of me becomes resistant. So what happened? I ask. Henri takes a deep breath.
I've had those visions too. So real it's like you're there.
I never realized how bad it all was. I mean, I know you had told me, but I didn't truly understand it until I saw it with my own eyes.
The Mogadorians are different than we are. Secretive and manipulative. Untrusting of almost everything. They have certain powers, but they're not powers like ours. They are gregarious and thrive in crowded cities. The more densely populated, the better. That is why you and I stay out of cities now, even when living in one might make it easier to blend in. It would make it a hell of a lot easier for them to blend in as well. About 100 years ago, Mogador began to die, much like Lorien did 25,000 years before that. They didn't respond the way we did, though. Didn't understand it the way the human population is beginning to now. They ignored it. They killed their oceans and flooded their rivers and lakes with waste and sewage to keep adding to their cities. The vegetation started to die, which caused the herbivores to die, and then the carnivores weren't far behind. They knew they had to do something drastic.
Henri closed his eyes, remained silent for a full minute.
Do you know the closest life-sustaining planet to Mogador?
He finally asks. Yes, it's Lorien. Or was, I guess.
Henri nods. Yes, it is Lorien. And I'm sure you know now that it was our resources they were after.
I nod. Bernie Kosar lifts his head and lets out a deep yawn. Henri heats a cooked chicken breast in the microwave, cuts it into strips, then carries the plate back to the couch and sets it in front of the dog. He eats with ferocity, as though he hasn't eaten in days.
There are a large number of Mogadorians on Earth, Henri continues. I don't know how many are here, but I can feel them when I sleep. Sometimes I can see them in my dreams. I can never tell where they are or what they are saying, but I see them, and I don't think the six of you are the only reason there are so many of them here.
What do you mean? Why else would they be here? Henri looks me in the eye.
Do you know what the second closest life-sustaining planet is to Mogador?
I nod. It's Earth, isn't it?
Mogador is double the size of Lorien, but Earth is 5 times the size of Mogador. In terms of defense, Earth is better prepared for an offensive because of its size. The Mogadorians will need to understand this planet better before they can attack. I can't necessarily tell you how we were defeated so easily, because there's much of it I still don't understand. But I can say for sure that part of it was a combination of the knowledge of our planet and our people, and the fact that we had no defense other than our intelligence and the guards' legacies. Say what you will about the Mogadorians, but they are brilliant strategists when it comes to war.
We sit through another silence, the wind still roaring outside.
I don't think they're interested in taking Earth's resources,
Henri says. I sigh and look up at him. Why not?
Mogador is still dying. Even though they've patched the more pressing matters, the planet's death is inevitable, and they know it. I think they're planning to kill the humans. I think they want to make Earth their permanent home.
I bathe Bernie Kosar after dinner, using shampoo and conditioner. I brush him with an old comb left in one of the drawers from the last tenant. He looks and smells much better, but his collar still stinks. I throw it away. Before going to bed, I hold open the front door for him, but he isn't interested in going back outside. Instead, he lies down on the floor and rests his chin on his front paws. I can feel his desire to stay in the house with us. I wonder if he can feel my desire for the same.
I think we have a new pet,
Henri says. I smile. As soon as I saw him earlier, I was hoping Henri would let me keep him. Looks like it, I say. A half hour later, I crawl into bed, and Bernie Kosar jumps up with me and curls into a ball at my feet. He is snoring within minutes. I lie on my back for a while, staring into the darkness. A million different thoughts swimming in my head. Images from the war. The greedy, hungry look of the Mogadorians. The angry, hard look of the beasts. The death and the blood. I think of the beauty of Lorien. Will it again sustain life? Or will Henri and I go on waiting here on Earth forever? I try to push the thoughts and images from my mind, but they don't stay gone for very long. I get up and pace for a while. Bernie Kosar lifts his head and watches me, but then drops it and falls back to sleep. I sigh, grab my phone from the nightstand, and go through it to make sure Mark James didn't mess with anything. Henri's number is still there, but it is no longer the only entry. Another number, listed under the name of Sarah Hart, has been added. After the last bell rang, and before coming to my locker, Sarah added her number to my phone. I close the phone, set it on the nightstand, and smile. 2 minutes pass, and I check my phone again to make sure I wasn't seeing things. I wasn't. I snap it shut and set it down, only to lift it again 5 minutes later, just to look at her number again. I don't know how long it takes to fall asleep, but I eventually do. When I wake in the morning, my phone is still in my hand, resting against my chest. Chapter 10. Bernie Kosar is scratching at my bedroom door when I wake. I let him outside. He patrols the yard, rushing along with his nose to the ground. Once he's covered all four corners, he bolts across the yard and disappears into the woods. I close the door and jump into the shower. I walk out 10 minutes later, and he's back inside, sitting on the couch. His tail wags when he sees me. You let him in? I ask Henri, who is at the kitchen table with his laptop open and four newspapers stacked in front of him.
Yes.
After a quick breakfast, we head out. Bernie Kosar rushes ahead of us, then stops and sits, looking up at the passenger door of the truck. That's kind of weird, don't you think? I say. Henri shrugs.
Apparently he's no stranger to car rides. Let him in.
I open the door, and he jumps in. He sits in the middle seat with his tongue dangling. When we pull out of the driveway, he moves into my lap and paws at the window. I roll it down, and he sticks half his body out, mouth still open, the wind flapping his ears. 3 miles later, Henri pulls into the school. I open the door, and Bernie Kosar jumps out ahead of me. I lift him back into the truck, but he jumps right back out. I lift him back in again and have to block him from jumping out while I close the truck door. He stands on his hind legs, with his front paws on the ledge of the door, the window still down. I pat him on the head.
Have your gloves? Henri asks.
Yep.
Phone?
Yep.
How do you feel?
I feel good, I say.
Okay. Call me if you have any sort of trouble.
He pulls away, and Bernie Kosar watches from the back window until the truck disappears around the turn. I feel a similar nervousness as I did the day before, but for different reasons. Part of me wants to see Sarah right away, though part of me hopes that I don't see her at all. I'm not sure what I'll say to her. What if I can't think of anything at all and stand there looking foolish? What if she's with Mark when I see her? Should I acknowledge her and risk another confrontation, or just walk by and pretend that I don't see either of them? At the very least, I'll see them both in second period. There's no getting around that. I head to my locker. My bag is filled with books I was supposed to read the night before but never opened. Too many thoughts and images running through my head. They haven't gone away, and it's hard to imagine they ever will. It was all so different from what I expected. Death isn't like what they show you in the movies. The sounds, the looks, the smells. So different. At my locker, I notice immediately that something's off. The metal handle is covered with dirt, or what looks like dirt. I'm not sure if I should open it. But then I take a deep breath and force the handle up. The locker is half filled with manure, and as I swing the door open, much of it comes pouring out onto the floor, covering my shoes. The smell is horrendous. I slam the door shut. Sam Good was standing behind it, and his sudden appearance from out of nowhere startles me. He is looking forlorn, wearing a white NASA t-shirt, only slightly different from the one he wore yesterday. Hi, Sam, I say. He looks down at the pile of manure on the floor, then back at me. You too? I ask. He nods. I'm going to the principal's office. Do you want to come? He shakes his head, then turns and walks away without saying a word. I walk to Mr. Harris's office, knock on his door, then enter without waiting for his reply. He is sitting behind his desk, wearing a tie that is tiled with the school mascot. No less than 20 tiny pirate heads scattered across the front of it. He smiles proudly at me.
It's a big day, John, he says.
I don't know what he is talking about.
The reporters from the Gazette should be here within the hour. Front page.
Then I remember. Mark James' big interview with a local paper. You must be very proud, I say.
I'm proud of each and every one of Paradise's students.
The smile doesn't leave his face. He leans back in his chair, locks his fingers together, and rests his hands on his stomach.
What can I do for you?
I just wanted to let you know that my locker was filled with manure this morning.
What do you mean, filled?
I mean the whole thing was full of manure.
With manure?
He asks confusedly. Yes. He laughs. I'm taken aback by his total lack of regard, and anger surges through me. My face is warm. I wanted to let you know so it could be cleaned. Sam Good's locker is filled with it, too. He sighs and shakes his head.
I'll send Mr. Hobbs, the janitor, down immediately, and we'll make a full investigation.
We both know who did it, Mr. Harris. He flashes a patronizing grin at me.
I'll handle the investigation, Mr. Smith.
There's no point in saying anything further, so I walk out of his office and head to the bathroom to run cold water over my hands and face. I have to calm down. I don't want to have to wear the gloves again today. Maybe I should do nothing at all. Just let it slide. Will that end it? And besides, what other choice is there? I'm outmatched, and my only ally is a 100-pound sophomore with a penchant for the extraterrestrial. Maybe that isn't the whole truth. Maybe I have another ally in Sarah Hart. I look down. My hands are fine. No glow. I walk out of the bathroom. The janitor is already sweeping the manure from my locker, lifting out books and placing them in the trash. I walk past him and into the classroom and wait for class to start. Rules of grammar are discussed, the main topic being the difference between a gerund and a verb, and why a gerund is not a verb. I pay closer attention than I did the day before, but as the end of the period nears, I start to get nervous about the next class. But not because I might see Mark, because I might see Sarah. Will she smile at me again today? I think it'll be best to arrive before she does, so I can find my seat and watch her walk in. That way, I can see if she says hello to me first. When the bell rings, I dash out of class and rush down the hall. I'm the first one to enter astronomy. The classroom fills, and Sam sits beside me again. Just before the bell rings, Sarah and Mark enter together. She's dressed in a white button-up shirt and black pants. She smiles at me before sitting down. I smile back. Mark doesn't look my way at all. I can still smell the manure on my shoes. Or maybe the odor is coming from Sam's. He pulls a pamphlet from his bag with the title, They Walk Among Us, on the cover. It looks as though it was printed in somebody's basement. Sam flips to an article in the center and starts reading intently. I look at Sarah. Four desks in front of me, had her hair pulled back in a ponytail. I can see the nape of her slender neck. She crosses her legs and sits straight in her chair. I wish I were sitting beside her, that I could reach over and take her hand in mine. I wish it were eighth period already. I wonder if I'll be her partner in home ec again. Mrs. Burton begins lecturing. She's still on the topic of Saturn. Sam takes out a sheet of paper and begins scribbling wildly, pausing at times to consult an article in the magazine he has opened beside him. I look over his shoulder and read the title, Entire Montana Town Abducted by Aliens. Before last night, I would have never pondered such a theory. But Henri believes the Mogadorians are plotting to take over Earth, and I must admit, even though the theory in Sam's publication is ludicrous, at its most basic level, there might be something there. I know for a fact that the Lorik have visited Earth many times over the life of this planet. We watched Earth develop, watched it through the times of growth and abundance, when everything moved, and through the times of ice and snow when nothing did. We helped the humans, taught them to make fire, gave them the tools to develop speech and language, which is why our language is so similar to the languages of Earth. And even though we never abducted humans, that doesn't mean it's never been done. I look at Sam. I've never met somebody with a fascination in aliens to the point of reading and taking notes on conspiracy theories. Just then, the door opens, and Mr. Harris sticks his smiling face in.
Sorry to interrupt, Mrs. Burton. I'm going to have to snag Mark from you. The Gazette reporters are here to interview him for the paper.
He says loudly enough so everyone in the class can hear. Mark stands, grabs his bag, and casually strolls out of the room. From the doorway, I see Mr. Harris pat him on the back. Then I look back at Sarah, wishing I could sit in the empty seat beside her. Fourth period is physical education. Sam is in my class. After changing, we sit beside each other on the gymnasium floor. He is wearing tennis shoes, shorts, a t-shirt two or three sizes too large. He looks like a stork, all knees and elbows, somewhat lanky even though he's short. The gym teacher, Mr. Wallace, stands firmly in front of us, his feet shoulder-width apart, his hands clenched into fists on his hips.
All right, guys, listen up. This is probably the last chance we'll get to work outdoors, so make it count. 1 mile run, as hard as you can. Your times will be noted and saved for when we run the mile again in the spring, so run hard.
The outside track is made of synthetic rubber. It circles around the football field, and beyond it are some woods that I imagine might lead to our house, but I'm not sure. The wind is cool, and goosebumps traverse the length of Sam's arms. He tries to rub them away. "Have you run this before?" I ask. Sam nods.
"We ran it the second week of class."
"What was your time?"
9 minutes and 54 seconds.
I look at him. I thought skinny kids are supposed to be fast.
"Shut up," he says.
I run side by side with Sam towards the back of the crowd. 4 laps. That is how many times I must circle the track to have run a mile. Halfway around, I begin to pull away from Sam. I wonder how fast I could run a mile if I really tried. 2 minutes? Maybe one? Maybe less? The exercise feels great, and without paying much attention, I pass the lead runner. Then I slow and feign exhaustion. When I do, I see a brown and white blur come dashing out of the bushes by the entrance of the grandstand and head straight towards me. My mind is playing tricks on me, I think. I look away and keep running. I pass the teacher. He is holding a stopwatch. He yells words of encouragement, but he is looking behind me, away from the track. I follow his eyes. They are fixated on the brown and white blur. It is still coming straight for me, and all at once the images from the day before come rushing back. The Mogadorian beasts. There were small ones, too, with teeth that glinted in the light like razor blades. Fast creatures intent on killing. I start sprinting. I run halfway around the track in a dead sprint before I turn back around. There is nothing behind me. I have outrun it. 20 seconds have passed. Then I turn back around, and the thing is right in front of me. It must have cut across the field. I stop dead in my tracks, and my perspective corrects itself. It's Bernie Kosar. He's sitting in the middle of the track, with his tongue dangling, tail wagging. "Bernie Kosar!" I yell. "You scared the hell out of me!" I resume running at a slow pace, and Bernie Kosar runs alongside me. I hope nobody noticed how fast I ran. Then I stop and bend over, as though I have cramps and can't catch my breath. I walk for a bit. Then I jog a little. Before I finish the second lap, 2 people have passed me.
"Smith! What happened? You were dusting everyone!"
Mr. Wallace yells when I run by him. I breathe heavily for show.
"I have asthma," I say.
He shakes his head in disapproval.
"And here I thought I had this year's Ohio State track champion in my class!"
I shrug and keep going, stopping every so often to walk. Bernie Kosar stays with me, sometimes walking, sometimes trotting. When I start the last lap, Sam catches up to me, and we run together. His face is bright red. "So what were you reading in astronomy today?" I ask. "An entire Montana town abducted by aliens?" He grins at me.
"Yeah, that's the theory,"
he says somewhat shyly, as though embarrassed.
"Why would an entire town be abducted?"
Sam shrugs. Doesn't answer.
"No, really?" I ask.
"Do you really want to know?"
"Of course."
"Well, the theory is that the government has been allowing alien abductions in exchange for technology."
"Really? What kind of technology?" I ask.
"Like chips for supercomputers and formulas for more bombs and green technologies. Stuff like that."
"Green technology for live specimens? Weird. Why do aliens want to abduct humans?"
"So they can study us."
"But why? I mean, what reason could they possibly have?"
"So that when Armageddon comes, they'll know our weaknesses and be able to easily defeat us by exposing them."
I'm kind of taken aback by his answer, but only because of the scene still playing in my head from the night before. Remembering the weapons I saw the Mogadorians use, and the massive beasts.
Wouldn't it be easy for them if they already have bombs and technologies far superior to our own?
Well, some people seem to think that they're hoping we'll kill ourselves first.
I look at Sam. He is smiling at me, trying to decide whether I'm taking the conversation seriously. Why would they want us to kill ourselves first? What is their incentive?
Because they're jealous.
Jealous of us? Why? Because of our rugged good looks? Sam laughs.
Something like that.
I nod. We run in silence for a minute, and I can tell Sam is having a tough time, breathing heavily. How did you get interested in all this? He shrugs.
It's just a hobby, he says,
though I get the distinct feeling that he's keeping something from me. We finish the mile at 8:59, better than the last time Sam ran it. Bernie Kosar follows the class back to the school. The others pet him, and when we walk in, he tries to come in with us. I don't know how he knew where I was. Could he have memorized the way to the school this morning on the ride in? The thought seems ridiculous. He stays at the door. I walk to the locker room with Sam, and the second he catches his breath, he rattles off a ton of other conspiracy theories, one right after another, most of which are laughable. I like him, and find him amusing. But sometimes, I wish he would stop talking. When home ec begins, Sarah isn't in class. Mrs. Benshoff gives instruction for the first 10 minutes, and then we head to the kitchen. I enter the station alone. Resigned to the fact that I'll be cooking alone today. And as soon as that thought occurs to me, Sarah walks in. Did I miss anything good? She asks. About 10 minutes of quality time with me, I say with a smile. She laughs. I heard about your locker this morning. I'm sorry. You put the manure there? I ask. She laughs again. No, of course not. But I know they're picking on you because of me. They're just lucky I didn't use my superpowers and throw them into the next county. She playfully grabs my biceps. Right, these huge muscles, your superpowers. Boy, they are lucky. Our project for the day is to make blueberry cupcakes. As we start mixing the batter, Sarah begins telling me about her history with Mark. They dated for 2 years. But the longer they were together, the more she drifted from her parents and her friends. She was Mark's girlfriend, nothing else. She knew she had started to change, to adopt some of his attitudes towards people, being mean and judgmental, thinking she was better than them. She also started drinking, and her grades slipped. At the end of the last school year, her parents sent her to live with her aunt in Colorado for the summer. When she got there, she started taking long hikes in the mountains, taking pictures of the scenery with her aunt's camera. She fell in love with photography and had the best summer ever, realizing there was far more to life than being a cheerleader and dating the quarterback of the football team. When she got home, she broke up with Mark and quit cheerleading, and made a vow that she was going to be good and kind to everyone. Mark hasn't gotten over it. She says he still considers her his girlfriend, and believes she's going to come back to him. She says the only thing she misses about him are his dogs, which she hung out with whenever she was at his house. I then tell her about Bernie Kosar, and how he showed up at our doorstep unexpectedly after that first morning at the school. We work as we talk. At one point, I reach into the oven without the oven mitts, and pull out the cupcake pan. She sees me do it and asks if I'm okay, and I pretend to be hurt, shake my hand as if it's burned, though I don't actually feel a thing. We go to the sink, and Sarah runs lukewarm water to help with the burn that isn't there. When she sees my hand, I just shrug. As we're frosting the cupcakes, she asks about my phone, and tells me she noticed there was only one number in it. I tell her it's Henri's number, that I lost my old phone with all of my contacts. She asks if I left a girlfriend behind when we moved. I say no, and she smiles, which just about ruins me. Before class ends, she tells me about the upcoming Halloween festival in town and says she hopes to see me there, that maybe we can hang out. I say, yeah, that would be great, and pretend to be cool, even though I'm flying inside. Chapter 11. Images come to me at random times, usually when I least expect them. Sometimes they are small and fleeting. My grandmother holding a glass of water and opening her mouth to say something. But I never know the words, because the image vanishes as quickly as it came. Sometimes they are longer, more lifelike. My grandfather pushing me on a swing. I can feel the strength in his arms as he pushes me up. The butterflies in the pit of my stomach as I race down. My laughter carries on the wind. Then the image is gone. Sometimes I explicitly remember the images from my past, remember being a part of them, but sometimes they are as new to me as though they never happened before. In the living room, with Henri running the Lorik crystal up each of my arms, my hand suspended over flames, I see the following. I am young, 3, maybe 4, running through our front yard of newly clipped grass. Beside me is an animal with a body like a dog, but with a coat like a tiger. His head is round, his body barrel-chested atop short legs, unlike any animal I have ever seen. He crouches, poised to leap at me. I can't stop laughing. Then he jumps and I try to catch him, but I'm too small, and both of us fall to the grass. We wrestle. He is stronger than I am. Then he jumps in the air, and instead of falling back to the ground as I expect, he turns himself into a bird and flies up and around me, hovering just beyond my reach. He circles, then comes down, shoots between my legs, lands 20 feet away. He changes into an animal that looks like a monkey without a tail. He crouches low to lunge at me. Just then, a man comes up the walk. He is young, dressed in a silver and blue rubber suit that is tight on his body, the kind of suit I've seen divers wear. He speaks to me in a language that I don't understand. He says the name Hadley and nods to the animal. Hadley runs over to him, his shape changing from a monkey to something larger, something bear-like with a lion's mane. Their heads are level, and the man scratches Hadley beneath the chin. Then my grandfather comes out of the house. He looks young, but I know that he must be at least 50. He shakes hands with the man. They speak, but I don't understand what they are saying. Then the man looks at me, smiles, lifts his hand out, and all of a sudden, I'm off the ground and flying through the air. Hadley follows, as a bird again. I'm in full control of my body, but the man controls where I go, moving his hand to the left or to the right. Hadley and I play in midair, him tickling me with his beak, me trying to get a grip on him. And then my eyes snap open, and the image is gone.
Your grandfather could make himself invisible at will, I hear Henri say,
and I close my eyes again. The crystal continues up my arm, spreading the fire repellent to the rest of my body.
One of the rarest legacies there is, developing only in 1% of our people, and he was one of them. He could make himself, and whatever he was touching, completely disappear. There was one time he wanted to play a joke on me, before I knew what his legacies were. You were 3 years old, and I had just started working with your family. I came to your house for the first time the day before, and as I came up the hill for my second day, the house wasn't there. There was a driveway, and a car, and a tree, but no house. I thought I was losing my mind. I continued past it. Then, when I knew I had gone too far, I turned back, and there, some distance away, was the house that I swore wasn't there before. So I started walking back, but when I came close enough, the house again vanished. I just stood there, looking at the spot where I knew it must be, but seeing only the trees beyond it. So I walked on. Only on my third time by did your grandfather make the house reappear for good. He couldn't stop laughing. We laughed about that day for the next year and a half, all the way till the very end.
When I open my eyes, I am back on the battlefield. More explosions, fire, death.
Your grandfather was a good man, Henri says. He loved to make people laugh, loved to tell jokes. I don't think there was ever a time that I left your house without having a stomachache from laughing so hard.
The sky has turned red. A tree rips through the air, thrown by the man in silver and blue, the one I saw at the house. It takes out two of the Mogadorians, and I want to cheer in victory. But what use is there in celebrating? No matter how many Mogadorians I see killed, the outcome of that day will not change. The Lorik will still be defeated, every last one of them killed. I will still be sent to Earth.
I never once saw the man get angry. When everyone else lost their temper, when stress encompassed them, your grandfather stayed calm. It was usually then that he would bring out his best jokes, and just like that, everyone would be laughing again.
The small beasts target the children. They are defenseless, holding sparklers in their hands from the celebration. That is how we are losing. Only a few of the Lorik are fighting the beasts, and the rest are trying to save the children.
Your grandmother was different. She was quiet and reserved, very intelligent. Your elders complimented each other that way. Your grandfather, the carefree one. Your grandmother, working behind the scenes so that everything went off as planned.
High in the sky, I can still see the trail of blue smoke from the airship carrying us to Earth, carrying us nine, and our keepers. Its presence unnerves the Mogadorians.
And then there was Julianne, my wife.
Far off in the distance, there is an explosion. This one, like the kind that comes from the liftoff of Earth's rockets. Another ship rises in the air, a trail of fire behind it. Slowly at first, then building speed. I'm confused. Our ships didn't use fire for liftoff. They didn't use oil or gasoline. They emitted a small blue trail of smoke that came from the crystals used to power them. Never fire like this one. The second ship is slow and clumsy compared to the first, but it makes it. Rising through the air, gaining speed. Henri never mentioned a second ship. Who is on it? Where is it going? The Mogadorians shout and point at it. Again, it causes them anxiety, and for a brief moment the Lorik surge.
She had the greenest eyes I'd ever seen, bright green like emeralds, plus a heart as big as the planet itself, always helping others, constantly bringing in animals and keeping them as pets. I'll never know what it was she saw in me.
The large beast has returned, the one with the red eyes and enormous horns. Drool mixed with blood falls from razor-sharp teeth, so large they can't be contained within its mouth. The man in silver and blue is standing directly in front of it. He tries to lift the beast with his powers, and he gets it a few feet off the ground, but then struggles and lifts no farther. The beast roars, shakes, and falls back to the ground. It forces a head against the man's powers, but it can't break them. The man lifts it again. Sweat and blood glisten in the moonlight on his face. Then he doubles his hands over, and the beast crashes to its side. The ground shakes. Thunder and lightning fill the sky, but there's no rain to go with them.
She was a late sleeper, and I always woke before she did. I would sit in the den and read the paper, make breakfast, go for a walk. Some mornings I would come back and she would still be sleeping. I was impatient, couldn't wait to start the day together. She made me feel good just to be around her.